Okay.
You've started.
The recordings have started. It's 11 o'clock on a Saturday. The calendar date is February 2nd, 2013. And on this tape, you'll hear stories of Marilyn Jones. Keith Sweet is the interviewer, and we are taping this at Mockingbird Ranch. Thank you for participating in Anwilor County's Living History Project. We appreciate your willingness to preserve our county's history by sharing your memories. This conversation is being tape recorded, and the tapes will be made available to the public without charge. If you share something during the next hour or so that you regret saying, we will make every effort to remove it before publication.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Marilyn, thank you very much for having me this morning. How did you hear about the program?
Two places. One from Rebecca Brown.
Rebecca Brown.
And in the newspaper also. And I thought, okay, I really got to do something this time. And the newspaper article had your email address. So that's when I finally decided I would do this thing.
Well, we're here at the ranch. And it's you were describing something about it earlier. It's a lovely place. I can understand why you wanted to come back, and because you told me that you had left. You were born in Jackson?
I was born and raised here, but as far as the place of birth goes, for both my brother, who's 2 years older than I. He's now 75, and I will be 73.
And your brother's name is?
Richard Jones.
Okay.
He will be 75, I'm sorry, the end of this month, and I will be 73 in October. And our mother, did not want us to be born in what was called the lying-in hospital or the laying-in hospital in Jackson, next in that area where the sheriff's office is.
Right, the old hospital.
Yeah. Because it really wasn't a hospital. It was sort of a makeshift. And so she was determined we would be born in a real hospital in Sacramento. And so we were. So it wasn't a problem for Rich. He was born in 38. And his firstborn mom got there in plenty of time. But when I went down, there was only an hour to spare. So that, for any woman who knows about childbirth, doesn't give you a whole lot of time. So the doctor was following in a car behind them just in case they had to pull over. That was my beginning. But we came home a few days later. In those days, women stayed in for a few days. And so I was born in Sacramento, but I like to say I was born here.
So the ranch, tell me just a little bit about the ranch. How long has it been in the family?
Okay. Our grandfather, Orlando Ori Jones, homesteaded this ranch in 1883 in August, the end of August. No, I take it back. That's not the month. I'm thinking of something else, which I'll add. But it was in 1883. And if I understand the Homestead Act correctly, you put a down payment down, which is around, I think it was $8. And then if you did your improvements within 5 years, you paid the additional $8 or $10 it was, I think. He was the youngest of children of our great-grandfather William Charles Jones and his wife Elizabeth McMurray Jones, who ran several of the stagecoach stations, the way stations in Amador County. The last one was the Jones Eureka Station off of Highway 88, not too far from the railroad trestle going to Ione. So Ori lived nearby this piece of property, which is in what is the area is called Sunnybrook. The year he homesteaded was also the year, and I can only imagine what it must have been like all over the world, Krakatoa exploded in August. And there were what they called garish sunsets because there was so much debris in the air all over. So I kind of remember 1883 because that was Krakatoa.
And he described them, or no, your family described them,
no,
as garish sunsets, or that.
No, it was described in many, many books and histories of the time and in newspapers of the time. Now, the only writing I have, we have from him, is a love letter he wrote to his first wife, who was, see if I can remember, Lucy Vogan. Lucy Vogan was the daughter of the, at the time, sheriff of Amador County. He died probably when she was a child, and her mother ran, I believe I have this right, ran a kind of quasi-boarding station, boarding house, way station over on the other side of this hill.
On Highway 88.
On Highway 88 in what's called the Mountain Springs area. And so we have a love letter he wrote to her before they got married. The marriage didn't last, of course, but...
Now, on this property then, he built a home. Is that the home that home's disappeared?
The home, the original ranch house was torn down in order for my father to build an adobe house. And the tearing down happened in the 40s. I can remember a little bit about that house. Like most quickly built houses of the time, there was no insulation, no cellar, no much of anything. They had a dugout underneath where my grandfather and later my father made peach brandy. But other than that, it was a pretty ramshackled house. I remember the pump in the kitchen was the way you got water. You pumped it. And their shower was on the back porch. There was some sort of tub above on a roof, and it was, when it was filled with water and warmed in the sun, you took your shower underneath it, which meant you sudsed up, wet yourself, sudsed up, and then rinsed off. The toilet was a privy, originally regular outhouses, and then later we had what was called a cesspool? None of which, of course, meets current standards.
No, not at all. So who lived in that house? Your grandfather?
Grandfather and grandmother. Grandfather Ori married. His last wife was Rosa Hoffman Jones. That was her third marriage. The story my dad told, and he told it in various ways, so that I was never sure exact truth, but that either Ori won her in a poker game or he went over the hill because she was living on the other side of this eastern ridge here we're looking at, went over the hill because she was living there with her second husband and they were having an affair. And then rather than fight with the guy, some money took changed hands. So take your pick of the story, and maybe neither is true. Anyway, Rosa was his last wife, and she was she came from a hard childhood. She was orphaned. Her family came over from Germany in the late 19th century. She was orphaned when both her parents died, and sold into or signed into, whichever way you want to look at it, I think money does change hands, signed into indentured servitude at age 10 and a half. She worked for the John Paxton family and lived in their place, their summer home in Healdsburg. It's still there, and it is a bed and breakfast, as you might imagine, called Madrona Manor. So my grandmother lived and worked there until she was 18, and she married her first husband and left.
And then came to Amador County.
Came to Amador County at some point, and I'm not sure when, and married her second husband and then Ori. So they lived there. Ori died first, and then I never knew him. He died before I was born. Grandma died when I was 3 or 4, the same with my Italian grandparents.
And they had how many children?
They had 3. The baby boy died in infancy. The next boy, William Charles, Billy died a teenager, we think, from meningitis. And then my dad was the only living one left. He had two half-sisters from Grandma's first marriage.
And you may have already mentioned your dad's full name.
Judson Comfort Jones. C-O-M-F-O-R-T. We're not sure where that came from. Because there's no names in the family genealogy of a Comfort.
Do you recall his date of birth and when he died?
He was born January 9th, 1912, the same day as Richard M. Nixon. My mother was born, Helen Mary Pettinati, April 15th, 19... Wait a minute, I got it wrong. Dad was in 1913. Mom was born April 15th, 1912, the day the Titanic sank.
So, yeah.
And she was born on Jackson Gate Road, not too far from where the senior center is now, in a house that's probably not there anymore.
The senior center is located on New York Ranch.
New York Ranch.
New York Ranch. How do you spell her maiden name?
Pettenati.
Okay. So, what can you tell us about your father and his growing up here?
He was actually born here. And one of the calendars that we still have said on January 9th, 1913, baby born snowed today. And, of course, he was born in the house where the adobe house now sits. He went to what was the name of the school? Mount Spring. I think it was called Mount Spring School. For the first, I don't know if he went there 8 years or not, before he went to Ione High School, which was called something, Ione Academy, I think it was still called then, I'm not sure. And so he walked to that school with a young boy named Ralph Dufresne. Ralph Dufresne lived on the other side of this hill in Mountain Springs.
That's D-U-F-R-E-N-E?
Yes. Capital D-U, capital F-R-E-N-E. The family's still in the family, in the county.
Right.
Alice is, his mother is now, it's going to be 100 this year. And if she's still got her memory as she did 2 or 3 years ago, you might want to interview her. So he was my dad's best friend, and they used to play every day after school. They'd play here, and then they'd go over the hill and play at Ralph's and come back here and play some more. And there was an interesting story that Alice told me, that one day they had a school teacher who believed some of these stories that were in the newspaper, apparently, and said that the world was going to end. It had been predicted that the world was going to end that day. So she sent all the kids home. Well, it didn't end, of course. They walked home, and they looked around, and they were looking at the sky. And she said that Ralph remembered that all his life, and nothing happened. They were bewildered. They walked all the way home thinking the world was going to end.
Sounds like it probably was very scary.
Very scary for them. Eventually, Ralph moved down to where that homestead is, family place is down near Buena Vista, where Alice lives and her son, Gene, who I went to school with. And then they met back up again when they both wound up at Ione High School. Now, I'm not sure how Dad got to high school, because he either rode a horse or maybe rode a wagon or something down there, because the roads were still pretty rough, and I don't think they had one of the old Model A Fords yet.
This would have been the high school in downtown Ione,
that is now the junior high school, where Rich and I went to high school also.
And you know about how far that is from here now?
It's probably about 5 miles. I mean, that would be something that a kid could walk, but I think he probably rode a horse. And maybe they had the Model A by then. I don't know. My brother might probably know.
probably told the story. You know, when I was a kid, I had to walk or ride 5 miles to school.
He would always say he walked to school barefoot to save his shoes. Now, that may not be true either, because he liked to embellish a lot, Dad.
Right. Well, it would have been an interesting walk.
And cross-country, I'm sure. The other thing is that a number of years back, a cousin was here. We were having a holiday meal, and he was looking at the old yearbooks from the high school when Dad was at Ione, and there was a picture of the baseball team, and they were all in their uniforms, and Dad was in his catcher's outfit. I knew he loved baseball, but I didn't realize he played. And then Bill, my cousin, looked up to me and he says, "Your dad caught for Ernie Bonham." And of course, dumb me, who's Ernie Bonham? Oh, well, he was, you know, a Major League Baseball player. So my dad was at least for 1 year the catcher of the Ione baseball team, and Ernie Bonham was then a teenager, and he was the pitcher.
Was your dad a talker?
Oh, yeah. Get him going. How I wish somebody had done an oral history on him, although who knows how much of that was so embellished that it, you know, may not have been completely true, but our memories are what they are. And, you know, mine are flawed, too, just like anybody else's.
Now, has this always been a working ranch?
It was up until probably the 60s. Before that even. No, until the 50s. We had a very small herd of cattle. We had a 5-acre orchard, mostly peaches, some almonds, some walnuts, some apricots. And we had somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 chickens. We sold the chickens as pullets, or very young chickens, and eggs. So we had plow horses and wagons and that sort of thing, and it was very, very hard going. During the Great Depression, when Dad was old enough to be working, they had to sell off half the ranch because things were so bad. Dad also told the story that there were some bootleggers way in the back somewhere making illegal booze and selling it, and then the bootleggers would often pay them in food, you know, beans and whatever else they had.
So your father didn't work anyplace else.
Up until about 42, 43, when the war was in full, you know, was really going. And my brother and I were, you know, babies, and there was no health insurance, and probably not enough money coming in either. Dad was still keeping the place going by himself. You know, that's a lot to be doing as just one person. And my brother Rich wasn't old enough yet to do it all. And by the way, they used to peddle what they called peddle fruit and chickens and eggs in Jackson. That's where they sold it. They sold it to the local grocery stores like the Purity Market and the Early Safeway, and probably to the Chickasaw store.
I was going to say, maybe to the old Chickasaw store.
Sure they did. And then to individual homeowners, too. People would buy his pullets, the very young chickens, and eggs and fruit, and they'd pile the truck up and take it to town. I still have memories of him packing peaches and selling them, and them going to, was it the Safeway? One of the sites of the Safeway was at the bottom of Summit Street. And
right.
I remember going in that store and Mom saying, "Those are our peaches for sale."
Were they making daily trips?
Not daily, because there was so much to do, but I imagine 2, 3, 4 times a week, something like that.
Do you remember what they were driving?
Pardon me?
Do you remember what they were driving?
My brother would. I know we had a couple of really, really old vehicles.
Would have been doing that with horse and wagon earlier.
And I imagine, I'm not sure if the Model A was a truck or a car. But we had that kind of, you know, really old trucks. And then they would sell a steer or two wherever you could take them. They were in the county now. You didn't have to take them all the way to Stockton.
So the chicken business lasted until when?
I think most of that he had to give up around the same time, the early 40s, and then way into the 50s, probably over a 10-year period, he finally gave up most of that. And in order to get a full-time job, he went to work at Preston. Became a what they called at the time a boys group supervisor, a prison guard, basically. At that time, Preston had...
This is Preston Castle, as it's now called,
yeah,
or Preston Boys School.
Yeah. It was later renamed many times, but the young boys who were in Preston then were probably better classified as juvenile delinquents. You didn't have murderers. You might have somebody who just got into a whole lot of trouble and maybe a couple of felonies, but not violent. They weren't violent. By the time Dad retired in, I always have to think twice now, 60s, early 70s, he had to watch his back because the kids were all violent then. They were really getting violent kids, and there had been a couple murders and that sort of thing. And he was very glad to retire. So by the time he got into Preston in the mid-40s, he let the chickens go, and over time, and then finally the orchard. And all those beautiful trees died.
So going back just a second, the house that sits here on the property now, which is an adobe house,
mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that house.
He built that in the 40s. So he was winding down the ranch at the same time he was getting ready to build there. And let's see. He must have started around 45 or so, maybe right after the war was over. Because it took him a couple of years to tear down the old house and get the site leveled and everything set. And then it took him 4 years to build the new house, a couple of years to build the bricks. And
now when you say build the bricks?
Build them. He made, we've got all that too. We've got, and I've got a little notebook that he kept. He spent, I'm trying to remember if I have the right numbers. It was a shockingly low amount of actual cash. It was all mostly labor. It was $2,800, $3,000 for everything, including the new washer and dryer and the furniture that we didn't bring from this house.
So those are adobe bricks, and the adobe was found on this property? And
he got interested in adobe because there was, I think he may have gotten interested because there was a man in Ione who was building an adobe house, which I think is there still, and that is still being lived in. And then Dad decided he wanted to build an adobe house because he thought it was a much better, more reasonable house in this climate, and cheap besides, if you made your own bricks. And so first he made the frames for the bricks, decided the sizes he needed and all kinds of things. So we still have those frames. People could still make bricks if they wanted to. And he got a recipe from some academic, I believe, at either UC Davis or UC Berkeley. He wrote a letter and said, how can I make the best bricks because mine don't seem to turn out all that well? And the guy told him what ingredients he needed and what percentages of everything. So it's mostly local clay soil because you need clay soil, straw, sand, bituminous oil. I'm not sure what else. I don't know that.
Got me. I have no idea, but...
I don't know the percentages of all that stuff. And so he made the bricks. It took him a couple of years to make them in thousands. Again, that's listed in this little book. Then he went, you know, went about building it, and it was quite a project.
Now, I noticed it's tile roof. Did he make the tiles for
no,
the roof?
No, those he bought apparently from some guy in the Lodi area, the cement tiles. Can't get them anymore. I mean, you can get them mass-produced, but these were made in a probably one-of-a-kind place. And we have, fortunately, when I was having this redone, the contractor looked around for some additional tiles for that place because we were going to put a covering, roof extension to cover sides of that house because it was starting to deteriorate on the outside from weathering. And so we used tiles, and we found a guy in the Lodi area, and we bought everything he had. So we've got tiles to last for several hundred years there because they don't break very often.
How big is the adobe house?
About 1,400 feet of square feet.
And there are how many bedrooms? Because you said earlier to me before we started talking that it was too small once the
three family. Bedrooms, yeah. My brother and I tossed for the bedrooms that we were going to get. So, yeah, we tossed a coin who was going to get which bedroom.
Now, we're in a house that's built next to the adobe house,
right.
your original home. This was built when?
This originally was built in 1934. That's when Mom and Dad... they may have moved in a little bit later. They eloped to get married in 1934. And I think she had to wait because he wasn't quite finished with his house. But it was within months of their marriage in June of 34. Original ranch house was still there then. This original house was built to here, which is two-thirds of this house now. And this is, if you count the loft, about a 750-square-foot house. Very tiny.
Well, obviously, you've done a little remodeling because it certainly doesn't appear that it's built in the 30s.
No. What our feet are on, the cellar underneath us and the original floor and everything and that wall over there, that's all original stuff. But all of this is new because it had to, again, no insulation, very, very old stuff. And I don't think we found termites when we were doing the remodel, but it's a wonder we didn't.
Now, there's a gorgeous fireplace in the kitchen area. Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. This is an open house, so everything flows into one another. The fireplace is all out of rock with a sandstone... The sandstone... piece that's on top over the
hearth. The,
that's what I wanted to say hearth too.
Yeah.
Anyway, the mantle. Sorry.
Mantle.
So the mantle is sandstone hearth, a sandstone piece, and all the rocks are from Amador County. And we always thought Dad had, devised this all by himself, but he was very good at adapting things, adopting and adapting. And when my brother and I went up to Volcano a number of years back, I believe it's a St. George Hotel that has an enormous fireplace. It looks just like this, only it's probably two to three times larger. And it's still all made out of local rock. There's crystal rock in there. There's some of these rocks that look like they have kind of a fern... pattern in them. It's a beautiful, beautiful collection of rocks. And so he adopted that apparently, that design, and liked it very much, and made one for himself. And let's see.
When
where are we going?
There's obviously I passed some cattle coming through here. Are people leasing the property
to run cattle? Yeah.
When did your cattle business cease?
Well, that was the same time in the 40s. We just stopped having cattle here, and we never had more than 6 or 12 cattle. We didn't have that many.
Do you recall any kinds of events that might have been held on the property at all that were on an annual basis or groups got together? Or?
None that I remember. It's not like we had roundups and, you know, lots of family coming and going. There's a story I'll tell you about the cattle, though. We almost always had at least one milk cow, of course. And whenever she was producing, we had the best milk you could ever drink. It was raw milk, of course.
Right.
In those days, you know, you didn't pasteurize your own milk. What we did, because it was a Jersey Guernsey milk cow that I remember the most, a Kalbasi, of course. I was not allowed to milk her because my dad was afraid I'd get kicked. And I regret that to this day, that I never learned how to milk a cow. We would take that very, very rich milk. People pay premium prices for Jersey Guernsey milk now. And we put it in pans and put those pans in the refrigerator. And the thick cream from that rich milk would come to the top. And you'd scoop that off and put it in big quart jars. Then for breakfast, when everybody sat down, Dad was, you know, able to sit with us on those days. Mom would make pancakes. And you'd have several pancakes. And between each pancake, of course, you'd put butter, homemade butter. I did churn butter. And a little sugar on top of the butter. And then you'd stack. And then on the top, you would pour the thick cream straight out of the bottle. And then a little sugar on top of that. Now, I have never had a cholesterol problem. My brother does. But I've since learned that there is a theory out now, and I don't know how well it's been proven, that Jersey and Guernsey cattle have something in their milk that doesn't seem to cause the cholesterol. It either changes the cholesterol chemically or whatever it is. And they say, well, you don't really have to worry if you get Jersey Guernsey cheese or drink their milk. Well, I don't know, but
started off good.
I started off good. That's a story I love to tell about those cows. That was the best. You cannot beat that for what to put on pancakes.
Well, you mentioned about your father getting to school.
Yeah.
How did you get to school?
Oh, bus. We took the bus.
Now, you had to walk out to the highway?
Sometimes Mom would drive us out. Quite often we would walk, unless it was really pouring. You know, if it was really nasty, we'd get a ride out. We caught it out there at Sunnybrook by the service station. The Sunnybrook service station was run by the Alexanders, Minnie and Floyd. They had a counter. I don't think they may have had a couple of tables. I don't remember that.
That'd be the property that would be, say, to the west of your driveway on the opposite side of the highway, just a few?
Not on the opposite side of the highway. Same side of the highway, down from the gate, several hundred yards.
To the west?
On the same side. It's actually south. It's on the south side of the highway. And the only thing left, it burned. The service station burned a number of decades back, but there is a cement flat kind of, you know, the original foundation, just flat.
So you had to make it to the highway and then the service station and then the bus picked up.
Yeah, and the bus would pick us up, and it would vary. Every year or two, they would change the schedule. Sometimes we were at the very first on the schedule. We'd get pick up really, really early and get to school on time. Or sometimes they would pick us up last, so we didn't have to ride for an hour in the morning. So we either had to ride for an hour in the morning or an hour at night, depending on what part of the schedule we were on. If you rode an hour in the morning, If I remember, that was the most common thing. We rode down through Jackson Valley Road, through Buena Vista, out past the old mine, and before Comanche was even there, we rode through the area that Comanche now covers. And then we come out way over past, over in the Highway 88 area. And there's a road that goes in back of Ione and then comes out at the end of West Marlette Road. That was a long drive, and we would often wind up riding that for an hour in the morning before we got to school, which meant we had to get up really early.
So you went through the entire school system, elementary, junior high, and high school,
there
all
was
in Ione.
There was never a junior high, and there was never a kindergarten. We went from first to eighth grade to the grammar school, it was called, and then we went for 4 years to the high school. I think sometime when we got, around the time we got to high school, there was a kindergarten at, and they were, they had their schoolroom in the basement of the Methodist church. The original grammar school is where we went, which is brick. It was a two-story brick building, and now it's just one brick, just one level. And it's, I think, belongs to a veterans group. I forget who owns that now. That somebody else would certainly know that, and I own. Then from about the sixth grade on, we went to the new grammar school, which is certainly old now.
Right.
And then over the hill to the high school.
When you were going to school, was each class in its own classroom? Did they have combined classes?
No. For most of the time, we were in our own classroom. Now, it got overcrowded, and for the fourth grade, I think there was another class that had to go to school downtown on Main Street in a building that used to be a store. When I was in fourth grade, we were sent out to what was called Union School. It's on 104 going out of Ione, well past, how far past? It's not too far past Mill Creek Prison. It's in with sight of Mill Creek Prison. The building's gone, but it was about an acre of land, and we were there. We were bussed out.
Was there some construction going on, or is there a reason why they took just that one class?
Too many children. It was getting crowded. Population increase. So we went to school at Union School, which was the best year of our grammar school. We all loved it because we're out in the country. We're just us.
So who was your teacher?
I wish I could remember her name. It may come back to me.
Do you have a favorite teacher?
Probably was the one. I really liked Mrs. Carpenter, who lived into her hundreds as well. Alberta McKean started teaching us what for the time was advanced math because she liked it and she thought we could learn it. She really wanted us to learn. She was a really good teacher.
Well, this was fourth grade.
Fourth grade at Union School. Yeah.
Advanced math. Do you have to recall what it was you were learning?
Oh, I think it was advanced division. It was, certainly wasn't anything in the area. I mean, it wasn't geometry, or it wasn't. It had nothing to do with the kind of advanced learning of our time. But she went into a lot of math that we normally wouldn't have learned until fifth grade or sixth grade. And she encouraged us to read, too. I was advanced in terms of reading because I read a great deal as a child, even though I didn't have close access to a lot of books. We had books in the house, but we didn't have a lot.
Now, I know you probably haven't been in any of the local high schools recently, or maybe you have.
No, I haven't.
Because my question was going to be, what do you think might be some significant differences between when you were in high school and today?
Much more,
other than the internet.
Oh, I was just going to say, not just the internet, much more access to information.
Today.
Not just the internet, that too, but just so many more books. So much more in terms of what libraries have to offer. So much more curiosity about everything. Probably even better trained teachers. I'd like to think so. Better role models, even, especially for girls. My role models were nurses and teachers. So, you know, that was sort of where I went. But I also think just having access to information that we just didn't have. Our idea of knowing what was going on in the world was watching the 15-minute long news on television and getting Time magazine once a week, and off and on we'd get the Chronicle, Daily Chronicle. Dad would get mad at the Chronicle and we wouldn't get it anymore. Get the Bee, or he'd get the Union, and if they didn't like what was all going on in the editorial pages, we couldn't get the paper for a while, that sort of thing. We just didn't have that kind of information.
What kind of activities were you involved with in high school?
Not much for me, because at the time, although I didn't know that I was going to lose my sight, I was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa when I was 21, right after I got my nurse's license. So my life changed dramatically several times in my life. But when I was a child, I knew I had night blindness, so I couldn't do a lot of things that other people could do. And so I didn't. I think I might have enjoyed being in some of the class plays, but you know, having a transportation problem way out here and not being able to see what was going on stage or backstage, I just didn't want to put myself through it. It was too embarrassing.
Did you consider yourself a country girl?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did. By the time I got into high school, though, I became very bookish and read everything I could get my hands on. A lot of them were school books. There wasn't much to choose from. We didn't have that great a library at school either. So I'm making up for lost time in my retirement. I read 4 to 6 hours a day. Let me show you. This is a very small reading device. It's a digital player. I can download books off the internet in minutes. I have currently on this very small SD card, only takes 18 gigabytes. I have 73 books on this right now. I have history, drama, poetry, fiction, everything. Right here in my hand. It's the size of a deck of cards.
And obviously you listen to it then?
All the time.
Yeah.
This one right now also has my SD card with The Economist, the latest editions of The Economist, the Sacramento Bee, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the New York Times. And I can download those. I don't have to go to the store. I download them every morning off my computer. That's what's different about living now for children and living when I lived.
Dramatically.
They have this kind of access. I didn't have that access. Not to say I didn't have a really good childhood. I did. My parents were good. They really tried hard for us. They put us through school. They put us through college.
Where'd you go to school?
Well, my brother went to Berkeley. I was going to be a nurse. So I went to St. Joseph's College of Nursing in San Francisco. As I said earlier, right after I graduated, got my RN license. Within the month of getting my RN license, I got the diagnosis. So that changed everything. So I decided that, and no one could predict, I decided I would work my way through and start over. So I worked my way through San Francisco State. It took me 8 years. I worked nights, the swing shift, first for a while I worked at St. Joseph's in surgery, and then I worked at the old Mary's Help Hospital on Guerrero Street. That was an ancient building that must have been built right after the earthquake, because it wouldn't have survived another one. And then we moved to Daly City. So Mary's Help became eventually Mother Seton. I worked the swing shift in surgery because I had a lot of free time, so I could read and study when we weren't busy.
You're working as a nurse, though.
Yeah, working as a nurse because I wasn't yet legally blind. I was worried about that. And I was watching it, and I was going to the doctor every year and making sure, okay, yeah. He worked and operated there, so he knew. So I said, okay, you know, I can keep going. He said, yeah. So by the time I graduated, got my degree, I also got married. And although the marriage didn't last, I had my degree, and later, while my husband was on sabbatical, I got my teaching credential. The irony was, back in the 70s, when I finally got my teaching credential, teachers couldn't get jobs just like now. So,
what was your credential in?
It was a high school credential, and I had majored in English and history. And I'd gone back because I thought maybe I could get also a job in home economics. So I also picked up a second minor. So all of that was on the credential. So I did a lot of substitute teaching in Yuba City, where my husband and I lived, and enjoyed substitute teaching because, of course, then in those days, you didn't take your life in your hands. In some schools, like, teachers really, really have to be on their toes now. The kids were not tough. They were basically good kids that try to get away with stuff. And I had a good time with them. Couldn't get a teaching job. So I finally, at that point, because I was legally blind by the time I was 30, and I was in my mid-30s, and my husband and I didn't divorce until I got a really good job, and he carried me on his health insurance all that time. Anything I would need, he'd be happy to give to me. We just were living apart then. I signed up with Department of Rehab, State Department of Rehab, and it turned out they had a program for people in rehab. And here's where I'm going to get on my affirmative action soapbox.
You have the time.
I was hired under an affirmative action program. I had to prove myself that I could do the job, and then I had to test in order to get on a hiring list. I did, and I was hired permanently. It was extraordinarily stressful. And if anybody says that it's stressful to be out of work, I understand them. I know exactly how that felt. Every day was a nightmare. Is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Am I going to have to give up? What am I going to do?
So when you got that position, that was where?
That was in Sacramento.
Sacramento.
And I worked for the state for about 15 years, got good jobs, good benefits. And one of the reasons I can live here is because I have a pension. A defined benefit pension that I paid into, and I also paid into on my own a 457 plan, which is like a 401k. I paid my share in order to be able to retire here. So, yeah, so I finally got a job with the state. I enjoyed it. Couldn't wait to get back here after I realized this is sort of where my soul was.
Do you remember how many students were in your graduating class, high school?
I think it was 32 or 33.
Do you remember how many of them might have gone on to school?
At the time, quite a few went on to at least junior college. Not all of them finished junior college, but quite a few did. I couldn't tell you offhand how many actually finished a four-year degree program or an advanced. I should know that. But I'd say at least a third.
I find it, just as an aside here from the interviewer, interesting that when I asked people where they were, where they went to school, or they identify where they went to school, there are just a large number of people in your age and a little bit younger that did go to school, in Berkeley, which obviously has been a little more liberal than most other campuses, and this is a very conservative community up here. I just find that just a little bit interesting.
It is. I don't remember if anybody else. I'm trying to remember who in my class might have. I don't think anybody in my class went to Berkeley, but I can't be sure. A lot of them went to state colleges. Like San Francisco State, Sacramento State. Some may have gone to UC Davis. I don't remember.
We were talking about Marion Cuneo earlier, who's obviously older than we are by several decades, probably, or a decade and a half.
Oh, I'm sorry, Cal Poly. A lot of them went to Cal Poly.
Cal Poly, right. She went to Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, just as an aside.
Yeah. Berkeley was sort of the ultimate goal, because it was sort of the sign that you'd made it. If you sent your kid to Berkeley, that meant something more than if you went to state college.
Now, your parents sent you and your brother off to school, and you said, how did they pay for that? Were you working part-time when you went to school and to help in that regard?
Not when I went to nursing school. I got full scholarship. I got two scholarships. One was Sir Optimist, and the other was local Sir Optimist. The other was Italian Italian Cultural Society, some Italian society. I don't know if the local group was part of, affiliated or not.
They didn't object to your name being Jones?
No. Actually, I'm told I look a little Italian. That paid for my tuition at nursing school. I didn't work extra until the last summer before I graduated, and then I worked at the old hospital. Amador County Hospital had a remodel after I worked, between the time I worked there as a senior student and as a nurse right after graduation. And then, of course, they moved across the highway recently. So Rich worked for the USGS because a cousin of his worked there. And so every summer he would be off in the wilds of Utah and Nevada and God knows where mapping. At the time it was all done by hand, of course.
This is while he was going to Berkeley.
Going to Berkeley. Every summer he worked that way. And then he became he was a civil engineer and he worked for Caltrans.
Did you have any summer jobs or work during the school year when you were growing up?
Mm-mm. No. And I don't remember that my brother did either. I did a little interview for a babysitting job, and I took one look at the kids, and Dad drove me home and he said, "Do you really want to do this?" I said, "No." I don't think I'd been very good around those little kids. I would not have known what to do with little kids acting out.
When you were growing up on this property, did you like it? Did you think it was difficult? It was out of the way?
The only as I got older, I realized that, you know, I was kind of out in the boondocks. But when we were young, we didn't know any better. We thought everybody had this kind of freedom to just roam anywhere you wanted to go. You know, watch out for snakes was what they always said. Watch out for snakes. Other than that, we were free to roam anywhere we wanted to roam.
You had horses?
Not to ride. And by the time Rich and I were in our young years, even the plow horse was gone. So we didn't have horses to ride. Once in a while, Rich would get on the back of a cow, but they didn't like it too well. But we just walked. We roamed and roamed and looked at things. We'd go down. There's a pond in back of the Ripley place. The Ripley place is what you saw as you turned in.
Okay, and I could see the pond as I drove in, right?
Before that pond was there, it was just a free roaming stream. There's still a stream coming out of it. We would go down there and play in the creek and just be amazed at all the creatures, the pond turtles and the skeeters, the little bugs that float across the top, and tiny little snakes, of course, and all kinds of things. And we would just play and find things. You don't need to have a game to play in a place like this.
No.
You can just investigate and love it. That's what we did. And didn't know that there were people who couldn't do this. If people lived in town, we didn't think much about it because town was so, Ion was so small that you could be out in the country within just a couple of blocks. So they had the same ability to roam, too. Got into plenty of trouble, I'm sure, like, you know, Rich and I did now and then.
Was it a treat to go into town? Did you think, look at it that way? Or was it just something that you had to go get groceries and come home? Or
it depended. We did all what we called trading. We did all our trading in Jackson. I still do all my trading in Jackson because that's where the banks are and, the, you know, the offices you need to go to. Everything's there still. I look upon going to town probably now similar to then. You go there to do something. Once in a while when we were little, when we were teenagers and we were able to date, we'd go to Jackson to the movies. And sometimes I liked the movies and sometimes I didn't. Of course, I had the problem of not being able to see when I went to the movies. I could see the screen okay, but I couldn't see anything else. Because it's dark. So I've never really liked the movies because of that. Going to town to shop and that sort of thing, yeah, it was fun because in those days, there were, you know, a lot of very interesting stores because there were a lot of places where you could get staples of not just food but clothing. The most exciting thing was when we would go to Sacramento to shop because, oh my God, that was a city. That was a city you could go to shop at Weinstock Lubin, neither of which exists anymore. And I can't remember some of the other stores, but there were just huge stores. And you just, wow, this was really the big time. The old K Street, which was still just a street and not some sort of crazy fancy mall that they keep tearing up and rebuilding. We had a great time. Just a great time going to Sacramento. We did that usually once a year. Mom would drive down when she was still able to drive. And we'd park and we would get clothing, school clothes for the coming year. That was before I started sewing all my own stuff. But we'd get shoes. And thinking back, we would go into the Buster Brown store for shoes. And we always looked forward to doing something which we now realize was awful, putting our feet in those X-ray machines.
Absolutely.
Getting a big dose of X-rays, seeing our feet.
I just, as an aside, I bought a pair of shoes the other day and I went home with them and realized that they were still a little bit too tight for me, and I went back to get a larger size, and I made the comment, I wish you still had these old machines you could put your feet in and X-ray your shoes. So.
Too bad they don't have something else, you know, like the scanners in the airports. I don't see why they couldn't do that. It would be less lethal to our body cells.
Did your family belong to any organizations, or did you?
Rich belonged to Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, and he's been a Boy Scout leader all his life, even now with all his sons grown. I went to a couple of Campfire Girl meetings and didn't like them all that much. And I don't think I can't remember anything else I belonged to that didn't just meet at school.
How about your mom and dad?
Mom was very active in the Catholic Church in Ione. So that was about her only social thing. And then that kind of faded as she got more ill. Mom was born, not diagnosed until she was in her 30s, with one of those dreadful systemic diseases called syringomyelia. It's also probably called an orphan disease because there's not that many people with it. It affects your body in the same way that, a combination of crippling rheumatoid arthritis, muscular dystrophy, multiple sclerosis, and Parkinson's, if you had all of those all at once.
Wow.
She was diagnosed in her 30s. Gradually, her hands crippled up, and she couldn't drive anymore. And then it was her legs. And finally, when she did die, because of the good care my dad gave her, and he was her full-time caregiver for the last 7 or 8 years of her life, she didn't die until she was one day shy of 77, which is very unusual for people with this awful disease.
So she lived all of her life, or the married life here on the property. Then.
Yeah. And she was very self-conscious about her hands and her appearance because it does shrivel up your muscles. And one of the first signs is that you do not feel pain. It's a terrible thing not to feel pain. She would burn herself and not know it. And then I'd get home from school and she'd have these humongous blisters on her hands. I'd bandage them.
Mm.
So
that was very difficult for him, obviously.
Yeah.
For many years.
Yeah. Difficult on Dad too.
What did your father die of?
He had cancer. Within a few months of her death, he started showing what turned out to be at the time cancer that had already metastasized, spread to his brain. So it was no use. They checked and tried to find the original source and never could. I suspect it probably was lung cancer, a very small spot that never grew very much and never showed up on MRIs at the time. And so my mom died in April of 90. No, I take it back. April of 89. By February of 90, Dad was showing some signs that might have been thought to be Alzheimer's. He wasn't functioning very well. My dad was a very smart man. He would have made a fantastic engineer because of his creativity. And anybody who's worked on this ranch says, who did this? How did they figure this out? And I tell them, well, my dad made do, and he knew what to do. He knew design work. He knew how to build and design. So Dad started showing these signs of not really knowing if he recognized people and what was going on. And he had trouble with math, and he never had trouble with math. He could add up a column of numbers faster than you could do it on a calculator. Think about that. So because Mom had had home health agency, I talked to them and I said, you know, is it possible that you could get Dr. Stubel to say to one of the nurses, go down and just check on him? Would have been called a welfare kind of check, sort of. And before that could happen, I got a phone call, and Dad had what was probably some sort of seizure. And when his niece, this is his kind of half, his half niece from his half sister's side of the family, and her husband couldn't get him on the phone, Jake, this is Jake Becker, drove down and found Dad on the floor, no clothes on, had relieved on top of himself, couldn't get up. He called 911 and took him into the hospital. And then we got the word from Dr. Subel that it wasn't a stroke. It was cancer. So they took him down to Sutter Hospital. Was it Memorial? Yeah, Sutter Memorial. And there wasn't a lot they could do. They gave him radiation treatment.
Now, you weren't living here at the time.
You hadn't
retired yet?
No, I was working in Sacramento. And so I was over there every day, and I said, okay, Dad, we're going to go home. And I was told, yeah, I could have administrative days. They used your sick leave for administrative days, and people could donate time. So my brother donated time, and a whole bunch of my staff said they'd donate time if I needed it. So I went home with him on the 8th of March, and he died on the 10th of June. And I was his caregiver, and glad to do it and do it again in a minute. And that was the time when I decided that I also wanted to live here and save this place, because I think it's worth saving. There aren't that many places like this left anywhere, especially in Amador County.
No, but you have some difficulty with your site. Do you have someone that helps you? Or?
Oh, yeah. There's a contractor who comes in here and does the repair work and whatever else, you know, the structural stuff, all that. Yeah, he's doing the termite work now, getting that all built back up.
Now, do you make sure they wear rattlesnake boots when they work here?
I forewarn them. And if they choose not to wear them, I say, okay, but you got to watch. I warn them that all rattlesnakes do not come in one size, that when they're newborn, they're the size of a pencil lead. I said, don't pick up anything like that. I have... Do you see that long-handled tool?
I do, yeah.
It's got a trigger handle, and it's 4 feet long, and it's got pinchers on the end. If you squeeze the handle, it moves the pinchers. So I have them all over the place. And so if I see a shape, whether I know it's a rattler or not, I pick it up behind the head and just drop it over the bank here or wherever I am. I just drop it someplace away from me. And that's what I do. As long as I can still see shapes, that's what I'll do.
I'm in Rotary, and part of our responsibility is cleaning up along the highway. And
mm-hmm.
so every time we use those pickers.
That's what they are.
And every time we do that, I always wear tall boots, too.
Yes.
Because you're out in the ditches out
there. Absolutely, yeah.
Those pickers come in handy. The orchard is right out here, as I take it. By the way, I'm looking out of the kitchen window here.
Oh, no, the orchard's not out of the kitchen window. The orchard is when you're coming in. And you're crossing that second cattle guard out there, the orchard is below you. And if you looked off to the south, you would have seen what was a packing shed and a couple of field tools, devices on either side of it, and some trees, some big, huge, it's on the downhill hillside, you can't miss it, and some big, huge walnut trees, and some smaller little cage trees, which is my constant battle, growing olive trees and other things. That was the orchard, 5 acres.
So after the war, you had an orchard, you were growing peaches.
that kind of dissipated? Did you just let them go fallow, or
he had to let them die, and he said that was the hardest thing he had to do as a farmer, was to watch his beloved peach trees die. He finally, you know, once they died, he had some sort of bulldozer device on his old John Deere tractor, and he just plowed them. He just, you know, and then burned them. I wish I had that John Deere tractor. It'd be worth a lot. It was an old thing.
Did you often go to the fair?
Not that much. We didn't enter stuff in the fair. Frankly, my dad and mom was too sick, couldn't drive to it. And dad was too busy working full-time at Preston, taking care of the ranch, simply even without any products. And no, he wasn't farming. He was just taking care of the place. You know, you've seen all these buildings.
Right.
Three large chicken houses, two large barns, two houses. Oh, here's what I haven't told you. Here's the other thing my dad did. When he retired from Preston, he had a second career. Before he retired, he taught himself television and radio repair, mail order, a mail order course. And apparently it was not all that uncommon. Now, these were tube devices. These were not...
the old Admirals and Raytheons.
Yes, and Zenith. Don't forget Zenith. He swore by Zenith. He repaired television sets. And yes, before we had silicone chips. And so when he retired, he set himself up in business with a Social Security number, because when he worked at Preston, they weren't part of the Social Security system. They were part of the California retirement system. And then they were given a choice later on whether they wanted to opt into Social Security or not. And Dad had it all figured out that he would do better by putting that money into stocks, and he picked a lot of blue chips and did well. Over time, he was very conservative in his investments. And then he figured out if he did enough quarters after he retired, that he could then qualify for Social Security. And that's exactly what he did. He had his own television repair business, and that's what he did. He repaired TVs mostly in Ion. So he knew all kinds of people.
Did he have a name for his business?
No, I think it was just TV repair service. I don't think it was anything fancy.
He didn't have a shop in Ion. He did it here.
In this building, before I retired and remodeled it, the whole living room, and of course, there were old television sets and stuff everywhere in the chicken houses. Things that people didn't want anymore, he'd take them and he'd scavenge the tubes. And he made a nice little income for himself, extra, and he got his minimum Social Security quarters, and then he was able to go on Social Security at some point, and so Mom got hers as well.
Yeah, a lot of teachers. I mean, I was a teacher for many years, and a lot of teachers used to work at the fair, Alameda County Fair, where I was teaching in Pleasanton. And to do that very same thing, get some additional quarters,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, get the quarters because not part of it. I had a question I was going to ask and I forgot it. Anything that you thought we were going to talk about that we haven't yet talked about?
I haven't told you much about my mom's side of the family. Lorenzo and Severina Pettinati came to this country in 1902, and he worked in the coal mines of Pennsylvania. And then, because there are a lot of Italians out here and he must have known some of them or heard about it, he moved here to Jackson and my grandmother, besides having five children, did some housekeeping work, I think, and may have done some cooking for other people, I'm not sure. But Grandpa worked in the mines, and so did their oldest son. Grandpa worked at the Kennedy. Joe worked at the Argonaut. He was still working on the day of the Argonaut mine disaster, but he worked a different shift, so he wasn't in it. Grandpa, I'm not sure how much underground work he did, but he suffered terribly from miner's lung. And towards the end of his life, he was a night watchman at the Kennedy, and then at, is it the Eureka in Sutter Creek?
Eureka.
Yeah, right. The Eureka. And another side of the family.
Where did they live?
In Jackson.
Remember where in Jackson?
Belwomany Lane. The top of Belwomany Lane, the house is still there. I almost bought it. I couldn't do it. I just, it would have been too much of a scrape. When my Aunt B died at 95, everybody, you know, the four first cousins wanted to sell. And I thought, oh, I'd want that house, but I just couldn't do it. It needed too much repair, and it would have cost me too much to get it ready for rental. But it's still there. They lived there most of the time when I was little, about three, and Rich was about five. Mom suffered from a very, very serious episode of clinical depression, and she was in Agnew State Hospital. Because Dad was then working at Preston, we stayed with our grandparents. My mother was gone for a year. During that year, and I don't remember any of it because I was too little. There was one afternoon when I refused to take my nap. And that was the day a fire started in that bedroom and the whole house burned down.
Oh, wow.
It's a good thing I've been stubborn all my life. They had to rebuild. And in the meantime, we rented someplace. And it must have been next door to Nick Kovacevic. And he and my brother were playmates at the time. And many years later, I said, you know, when he was about to operate on me, you know, told him about that. He says, I kind of remember Rich. He says, I don't remember you. I says, just as well. So we had some, you know, pretty close ties in Jackson. And then my dad's half-sister lived, I don't remember the name of the street, Highway 88 going out of town, the little bridge that comes over from Water Street, and then you go across the bridge, and then the street that's right next to the creek on that side of Highway 88, the end of that street, Bertha and Al Taylor lived. Bertha was my dad's half-sister. Al used to be the blacksmith at the Kennedy Mine. So, obviously, he knew Grandpa. He knew Lorenzo Pettinati. My mother, as I said, was born out on New York Ranch Road. And so that must have been way before they had the house on Belwomany Lane.
You don't recall what jobs they had at the mines?
I know that Grandpa worked in the mines, and I'm not sure how old he was and whether he was still working down below or not. I know Joe worked down below, but I don't know what kind of jobs he had.
Jackson had kind of an interesting reputation, you know, for being a rather open city during its history up until the mid to late 50s.
Did any of that ever, I don't know what I want to say or how I want to ask the question. Was that ever discussed, ever thought about, ever, you know, do you recall any conversations?
I remember.
You went downtown Jackson and a lady walked down the street, do you recall those?
I remember my parents doing their best not to let us know there was stuff going on up there. I remember there being a 5-cent, what did they call them? The old-fashioned gambling machines.
Slot machines.
Slot machines. I remember a 5-cent slot machine at the service station out here. The Alexanders had a 5-cent slot machine in their place. It was open. I mean, it's right out there in plain sight. Illegal, but there. And I remember one day Mom went over there to put a couple of nickels in. And I said, can I do that? And she said, sure. And then all of a sudden we hear, she can't do that. She's underage. And I thought, oh, I got my mom in trouble. I didn't realize it was illegal.
It was illegal for your mom.
And I remember that something really, you know, important happened when the elder Governor Brown, who was then state attorney general,
I guess,
took us on, probably to the regret of a lot of politicians in Sacramento. It took on the prostitution and gambling and so on and shut us down. The only other thing I remember is when I worked the first summer I worked at the old hospital. And I really liked the women I worked with. Mom said, well, who are you working with? I gave them the names, and I don't remember them anymore. Although I remember the director of nurses was pretty well known.
Just for clarity, when you're talking about the old hospital, you're talking about the hospital that was torn down to put up the new county administrative building.
Yes.
Not the old hospital district attorney's in now. Right.
But it was before they remodeled the old hospital. Not the old hospital. Before they remodeled the old hospital. That it was much different. Mom says, oh, she was a prostitute about one of the aides. I said, well, who cares? You know. And I thought, I wonder if that followed those women all their lives, if they chose to lead a regular life, get married, have children, and yet people remembered them for that all their lives. I was disgusted thinking that that's how people remembered her, because she was a really nice woman, or really good with patients.
I've always been taken by the number of people who I've spoken to over the last 20 years who lived in Jackson or in the county, and women who were, you know, when I'm speaking with them, they're in their 70s or their
mm-hmm,
80s,
mm-hmm.
are somewhat upset that Governor Brown took that action, you know, or Attorney General Brown took that action. You know, it was like they did something to our community that was part of our community, and they should, you know, and I've always found that interesting that a lady in her 70s or 80s should be concerned about having lost gambling and prostitution.
Gambling did bring a lot up here, and well, we have it now, only it's legal at the casinos. But from the reading I do, I think that there was this strange kind of morality. In those days, remember, Keith, women did not have birth control. And if you were a Catholic and practiced birth control, you were going to go to hell forever. And there were a lot of Catholics in Jackson and a lot of very strict religious people of other faiths. Women just did not take birth control, there was nothing, and men would not use condoms. But if you had prostitution, men could go get satisfied, and then their wives wouldn't have any more children because they had too many they could take care of anyway. It was birth control, basically. that's one of the things I think is going on, has been going on, and it's still going on in some cultures in this world.
Yeah.
It's
could very well be
not
what,
the solution.
Yeah.
It's certainly not the solution. Doesn't help a marriage any.
No.
It hurts a marriage a lot.
Well, I think I want to thank you for your time.
I've been on the soapbox a little here.
No, that's what we do. We
okay.
want you to talk. I'll just shut these off. And
okay. And I'm also working on my brother, and I think he may be more amenable now that the weather's better. So
good. Okay. It's 10 a.m. on Thursday. Calendar day is April 11th, 2013. On this tape, you'll hear some additional remarks by Marilyn Jones, Part 2. I'm Keith Sweet, and we are at Marilyn's home in Amador County. Thank you for talking to us again.
You're welcome.
We've talked last time a little bit about the city of Jackson and some of the events that took place there and the cultural aspect of gambling and prostitution and so forth, and you made some remarks and you wanted to follow up a little bit on that.
Yes. In the mid-50s, and I should have probably done a Google search to find out when the crackdown on illegal gambling and prostitution took place exactly, but it was in the mid-50s when Pat Brown was running for governor, as I remember. And he won. And I think he got a lot of attention because of his shutting down of all these illegal activities, even though the local activities got a lot of business from the politicos and other Sacramentans. My comment about prostitution at the time was in respect to what you had said, that there were a couple of women that you had met or talked to who said something about they were sorry that it was shut down because it was a way of life. That's true in that it probably had been going on since pioneer days, since the early gold rush. And so it had been going on for so long that people in this county probably didn't really realize how detrimental it was in the long run. Nobody wins when there's that kind of illegal activity. And at the time, it was probably an outgrowth of the old body saloons. You know, the Miss Kitty character, but the Miss Kitty characters are these women with a heart of gold, prostitutes who run a saloon. Prostitution's not like that over the centuries, and it's been called the oldest profession, probably because we've always had prostitution as a species, and no one wins with that. The customers don't really win in the long run, and certainly the women don't win. Well, women and men don't win. It is a presence and will always be a presence with the human race. In the days that we had it here, there was probably a lot of exploitation of these women. Most commonly, they find themselves trapped and not enough to live on, and dealing with disease and degradations and so forth. It's not a pretty life. And it bothers me when the movies make it sound like it's okay. And nowadays, of course, we've gone global with this. The pornography sex slave industry, and it is an industry, uses little boys and girls, young boys and girls, men and women, and their throwaway people. And we shouldn't forget that. We live in a world where these things do happen. I'm sorry that our county was known for being wide open, but history is history. It was. And it's important for all of us to know that it happened here. One other sidebar that I want to add to this. About the same time in the mid-50s, polio hit. And at least one young girl that I knew, Barbara Sinclair, Bobby, got polio. She was lucky. She was in my brother's class. She was lucky because she had a mild case and she has not had any residual, even the post-polio syndrome that often people get in their later years. She's been very lucky. One of the things that happened in Ione, where she lived with her two brothers, Mike was in my class and Dan, who lives there now. One of the things that was going on there forever was open sewage in the town. Between each street and the sidewalk or path between the street and the path, there were open ditches with open sewage. And there was absolutely no wastewater treatment system. Nothing. And it was like that because the voters of Ione did not want their taxes, their property taxes, to go up. Sounds a little familiar, but in those days they figured, we've been living with it all this time. It's good enough for our parents, it's good enough for us. Got pretty ripe smelling, let me tell you, in the summertime.
In Ione.
In Ione.
In the 50s.
In the 50s.
Interesting.
When polio hit, that was just one more and probably one of the biggest reasons that the parents and property owners who were parents were terrified. My mother was terrified. My mom and dad were terrified. They wouldn't let us go swimming for a long time after that. Swimming in public pools or anywhere. Sewage, of course, can carry the virus. And even then they knew it. The scientists and medical researchers knew it. And I suspect there was also a lot of push at that time from the early regulatory commissions at the state level. But that also happened in the 50s. Ione finally got a wastewater treatment system. Now, of course, they are still battling. The wastewater treatment system is not in compliance at this time and for the last 10 years, but that's another story.
Right, and that's endemic to wastewater systems throughout the state.
Yes, I imagine. And you probably know a whole lot more about it than I do, but...
Right.
But that was another part of the story. And the reason I remembered it was because my dentist, who worked on my teeth this week, had just come back from the Dominican Republic. And he's also gone to places in Africa. So while he was grinding away in my mouth, I said, I want you to entertain me. I want you to tell me stories. And he said, well, in the Dominican Republic, he just happened to come out with this, they do have septic systems. There's not open sewage, but there is in places in Africa where he'd been. And afterwards, I very carefully spoke because I was pretty numbed up and told him about Ione, and they were flabbergasted. I said, this was in my lifetime. It's not been that long ago. We tend to forget how quickly progress happens sometimes in one person's lifetime. And that happened in the same decade that they shut down illegal gambling and illegal prostitution all over the county.
You may not know the answer to this, and other researchers could certainly find out. Were there many cases of polio, do you recall?
I don't remember. I only remember Bobby because she and Mike were... the same age as my brother and myself. I think there may have been, but I don't remember how many. That's probably somewhere in the archive.
Oh, I'm sure it is, yeah.
But it was, mothers and fathers were just terrified. I don't remember if Bobby was the first one either. But people were just terrified, and all the parents saying it because of the open sewage didn't help. That's for sure.
Well, maybe it's terrible to take a tragedy like polio, an issue to get people motivated, but probably was a good thing then.
I think it was a big factor simply because people started realizing that there could be other things their children could get from the open sewage.
Well, maybe others will tell us about the sewage systems in the other cities as we continue to talk to people.
Yeah.
You have lived a life with some personal difficulties in terms of your eyesight.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. I didn't talk too much about it in the first interview because I wanted to get in so much about the family history. I have a disease of the retina called retinitis pigmentosa, and it is hereditary. I'm the only one in the family, in all the genealogy I've done, I'm the only one in the family that has it, thank goodness. The only symptoms I had in my early childhood and as a teenager was night blindness. From maybe the second or third grade, I wore glasses. And my mom insisted that I go to an ophthalmologist in Sacramento, which I did. And he never diagnosed me. And I do believe he didn't know what he was looking at. And that was why. I do not want to think that he knew and didn't tell my parents or me. He's long gone. There's no reason to cause blame because it wasn't that well known probably by a lot of ophthalmologists of the time. So it wasn't until I had gone to nursing school, had just gotten my RN license, and was ready for my regular eye checkup, that I went to an ophthalmologist that I knew from nurses training in San Francisco.
Let me interrupt just one second. So night blindness was really the only symptom that you experienced as you were growing up?
Thing I noticed, and I'll get back to my looking back on those days in a minute. So I went to Dr. William Ferguson, who's probably also long gone, and he diagnosed me. And when I went in to have a field of vision test, which checks your peripheral and central vision and how much you can see, in those days, and it's really hard to believe this given our technology of today, in those days it was somebody covering up your eye, telling you to look straight ahead, and marking on a chalkboard where you could see and where you couldn't see, and then filling in your visual field. And when I saw that, I realized, being a nurse then, my goodness, I've lost eyesight. I wonder what this is all about. I wonder if it's glaucoma. And then I was diagnosed. Well, looking back on my childhood, I was a klutz. I was always stumbling over things and falling and skinning my knees. The little girls wore dresses and skinning my knees. And so now I realize when I was diagnosed, well, no wonder I was always clumsy. I couldn't see. So I'm putting my hand below, moving it below my chest and my shoulders and my neck. I can't see that hand. I can't see it. Now I can. I'm looking at, out of one eye, I have a minimal amount of vision in it now. So over the last, 50 years, I have lost all the eyesight in my right eye and I have a tiny sliver in my left. And what happens with retinitis pigmentosa is in most cases, you lose your peripheral first, and then you get down to a tunnel vision, and then you lose the center as well. The night blindness comes because the rods, which are the are one kind of retinal cell, are mostly in your periphery, whereas the cones, which give you acuity and color, are mostly in your central vision.
So even though you thought you were only losing your night vision, or had night vision problems, you actually were had peripheral issues.
Yes, and didn't know it.
And didn't recognize
and didn't
it. You thought
it.
Everybody stumbled over rocks and things.
I just thought I was klutzy. Yeah. So as soon as I was diagnosed, it was pretty devastating. My parents, of course, had this huge load of guilt on them. And no matter what I said, this was a roll of the dice, you know, Mom and Dad. This, you have no way of, you had no way of knowing.
Well, there would not, was there a cure? Was there anything that could have been done
Nothing.
Had it been diagnosed when
Nothing.
You were 5 years old?
Nothing. There's still no cure or treatment. There's no treatment. There's no cure. But what they know now, thanks to the Human Genome Project, and thanks to a lot of research and a lot of heavy research money going into retinal diseases, which now includes macular degeneration, which is on the rise in people our age. Sorry for the reference, but it's true.
She's referring to the older gentleman sitting here
in control of the tape of the recorder. They have to come up with something that will work, that will either slow down or reverse retinal disease. Or we're going to have a whole lot of older blind people. Now, this may sound strange, but for me, it was a lot easier growing up with this, becoming an adult with this, and learning about it as an adult, a young adult, to adjust in the way that I learned to be a really good problem solver for when I needed to do things differently and to get help. An older adult, never having had a disability and coming into the knowledge that they're going to be blind, whether it's from macular degeneration or diabetes or glaucoma, these people tend to be terrified and so depressed they can barely function. They rarely go to the kind of aids where you learn how to use a white cane. It's hard to do that both emotionally and mentally, in the sense that you have to really learn how to do it. And emotionally it's hard because you're labeling yourself for the whole world to see. Most older people don't want to do that, and they don't want to be disabled. So there's a whole big problem with older people who can't see. They really get terribly depressed.
And since you kind of grew up with it, so to speak,
yes,
and then obviously acknowledged it and understood what it was, you know, in your as a young woman, clearly you've overcome many of the difficulties that older people would have now experienced. You know, it would probably not as easy for them to overcome. I'm sitting here in a fully equipped kitchen,
mm-hmm,
with a fully equipped computerized office behind you.
Mm-hmm.
So those things are.
But I've had to learn what aids I need and when. And fortunately, I have contacts in Sacramento, friends that are either have my disease or who are blind themselves. And I learn about where I can get help. But it's not always been easy.
Right. Do you think that your eye problems changed at all? I mean, changed how you reacted to people or how you participated in things,
yes,
when you were growing up?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It took me a long time before I started to get comfortable, and this is a cliche, but comfortable in my own skin again. In other words, I didn't know what was going to happen and how fast. When I was first diagnosed, I thought, well, I better hurry up and get my degree and change into another profession. And because teaching was something I knew I could do, might not be passionate about it, but knew I could do, that's where I headed. So I got my degree. I worked my way through because I didn't know how much longer I could work as a nurse, because that was my ticket to getting a degree, is working my way through. In those days, you didn't take out loans. You worked your way through if your parents and family didn't have the money.
Right.
It's not like it is now. It was a few $100s a year as opposed to many thousands of dollars a year.
But as you were growing up, do you think you avoided certain things?
Oh, absolutely.
Recall?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. There were activities I wouldn't try, or I wouldn't do alone. I think I mentioned in the other recording that I didn't want to participate in any kind of dramatic productions. Because at that time, of course, I didn't know about my RP, but I felt self-conscious. And I felt extremely self-conscious at night. So I rarely went out at night, even when I was living in San Francisco. And it, you know, became more and more a problem. I stopped driving in 1965, only 4 years after I was diagnosed. I was terrified I was going to hurt somebody. And I went in and near my birthday in October of 1965, and the eye test they gave you, which was absurdly inappropriate for somebody with my eye problem, I had problems with it. You were supposed to identify a clear object, and they were all fuzzy to me. And I said, well, it looks like, I knew what it was. I said, well, it looks, but saving face, I said, it looks like I need to get new glasses. And, everybody behind me, yes, you know, you can do it, you can do it. I drove home, and that was the last time I drove.
So that old truck out in the driveway, you don't run around the ranch on that then?
No, that belongs to the contractor here, yeah, right. So I sold my little Volkswagen Beetle, which broke my heart. But that was one of the hardest things I ever had to do. And I knew I had to do it, so I did. And well, so those were some of the major changes that I had to make in my life. And then I learned that if you walked where you wanted to go, and in the city it was easy to do that, then you got exercise too. And I became quite a walker.
Well, hopefully that someone might be listening to this in the future will take heart that your activities are not necessarily curtailed by your disease.
And I think that so many people are afraid of disability that they cannot imagine themselves ever dealing with any kind of disability. You came in here because you, for the time being at least, you have to use a cane because of an injury to your leg. And what would you feel like if you had to wear crutches, use crutches the rest of your life? That would be a real
very difficult
hassle. People who get diabetes don't realize how disabling it is. It messes up every organ in your body, gives you peripheral neuropathy, which means you lose sensation in your limbs, most commonly in your feet and lower legs. That's a terrible disability to have. And people, when it happens to them, they can't deal with it. Well, it's my belief that human beings are the best problem solvers on the planet. And if you have a disability, you learn how to deal with it. And if you don't, you might as well curl up in a corner and not live. And life is too precious to throw it away.
Well, thank you for sharing those thoughts. I know that you wanted to talk a little bit more about your mother. We briefly mentioned her in our first discussion.
Yes. I did mention that she was born in Jackson near what is the current senior center on New York Ranch Road. And she was the youngest of five. She grew up along with her three sisters and brother in Jackson.
For this tape, let's your mother's maiden name.
Helen Mary Pettinati, P-E-T-T-E-N-A-T-I. And The family wound up eventually on Belwomany Lane. The house rebuilt after a fire is still there. She.
Do you remember that address?
I don't remember the address, but it's at the very top of the little street. There's no going around it. It's the only one. And when she went to high school, I have a wonderful picture of her in a basketball uniform. She loved sports. I hadn't known that until I saw that. She was born in 1912, so she was in high school in the late 20s, in the mid to late 20s, because she and my dad got married in 34. And I remember, because Alice Sutton, who is now Alice Dufresne, told me about a coach who was also one of the teachers, how they had to wear these long, almost dress-like costumes to play basketball in, and knee-high socks for modesty's sake. And one day, it was very hot, and the girls wanted to take the socks off so they at least have a little cooling off. And they went outside, and somebody saw them. And the teacher got into big trouble because they hadn't worn their knee-high socks. A different lifetime. After high school, she was a housekeeper. She worked for some of the richer families. Now, by that, I have to tell you that although her family was not as dirt poor as my father's, they were not as well off as what some people would call maybe middle class now. It was a different time, so that even people who didn't have a lot of money could hire somebody to help them cook, clean house, serve at tables if they had company coming, that sort of thing. That's what my mom did for several years. And she wound up doing that kind of work around people she'd grown up with, which apparently wasn't all that unusual, except, of course, it probably made her feel rather inferior. You are the servant. And these are the kids you grew up with, and you're serving them. I can't quite imagine how that must be. After she met my dad, and apparently everybody went to the dances, the big entertainment was big band music and dances, and they would have them all over Amador County and Calaveras County. So usually on Friday or Saturday nights, that's where all the young people went to have fun.
Do you remember where the dances were might have been held?
No. No. I don't know that. And probably some of those buildings are long gone. And that's where she met my dad. And after Alice Dufresne told me about some of the dances she had gone to, I thought to myself, I had never seen my mom and dad dance ever as a child. I never saw them dance. But they must have been pretty good. And then when she married Dad, they moved to the ranch here, and it was 4 years before they had my brother in 1938. Dad was full-time farming. Mom was getting used to working and living on a ranch and keeping house and helping him whenever she needed to. I was born in 1940, and it was about probably 1950-ish or maybe 1948, somewhere in there, where I remember that the four of us went to, it must have been Sacramento, because that's where the physician was that diagnosed her with syringomyelia. I suspect that she was sent there to a specialist because she was losing the sense of pain, hot and cold, in her hands. And the doctor couldn't figure out what was wrong. And she was diagnosed then. And of course, doctors didn't know that much about syringomyelia. It's one of the orphan diseases. There aren't that many people with it. It consists of cysts forming in the spinal cord. It kind of makes you cringe a little bit just to think of it. And those cysts interfere with the neurotransmission of impulses to your muscles. And when that happens, it interrupts the nerves in your extremities, and you can't feel heat, cold, pain, and sometimes very little in the way of touch.
How did she have to adjust living with that?
Oh, it was, it must have been so hard for her. She didn't talk about it much. She was extremely self-conscious. In fact, she stopped driving only a few years after that when my brother and I were old enough to get our learning permits and get our licenses.
So she lost a sense of touch as well? Or
touch, in that you could touch her and she knew you were touching her, but she couldn't feel you. Like the sensation of when we touch somebody or touch ourselves, you can truly feel that. But if you've ever had an arm or a leg go to sleep on you, you really can't feel the touch when you
right.
touch it. That kind of thing. I don't think it was similar, but it was that kind of sensation.
So she could pick things up and knew.
She could pick things up, yeah, which caused her the next set of problems, which was not only was she starting to have trouble gripping the wheel of the car when she drove, which is why she eventually had to stop driving, but when she picked up a pan in the kitchen, she didn't know whether it was hot or cold, and so she would burn herself. The inside of her hands would just get terrible burns. And then gradually her fingers started contracting, and it became harder and harder for her to use her hands.
And, of course, local physicians obviously, I say obviously, weren't first in that particular disease.
We didn't have any specialists in the county, other than eventually there were probably obstetricians here, but no, they just had generalists in the county then, and there wasn't anything anybody could do about it.
That and a trip to Sacramento was an all day event.
Yeah, and I remember my brother and I waiting and waiting and waiting in this. It was a rather sunny waiting room, and we waited and waited and waited. It seemed like hours. I don't remember a lot when Mom and Dad came out, but they came out of an elevator, and we were so glad to see them because we were bored to tears. There was nothing for us to do, nothing to read, nothing. And they didn't say a whole lot. And then we went home, and it wasn't for a long time before I began to realize what she actually had. I was a little too young to fully take it in. And I learned more as I got older, and when I went to nursing school, then I realized there's nothing, there's no cure, there's nothing. They do, now, there are some people who benefited from some surgery, but it depends on each case. And like so many other things, there's a family of diseases involved here. There's many different types.
But your father and your mother continued to live on the ranch for their entire life.
Yes.
And
she died here, and she struggled every day to function as well as she could. And something of a role model for me, a huge role model. As she got older and the disease took over more and more of her ability to function, she never gave up. I mean, I'm sure she got depressed a lot, but she didn't give up.
Were there any other siblings that acquired this disease?
No. No, and as far as I know, it's not truly hereditary. It's simply a genetic mistake. It's a mutation of some kind. They're still learning about those kinds of things. Why does it happen? It's a roll of the DNA, roll of the dice. And with mine, which is probably a recessive type of RP, there's recessive, dominant, and sex-linked. And then there's the oddball, which nobody can identify. I've never had a DNA test to tell me exactly which kind I have. They can tell you now, not that it, you know, does a whole lot of good, except
right.
if you've got a dominant kind or a sex-linked kind, it would make a difference to families who are going to have children. But because I got it, my brother could have easily been the one who got it instead of me.
Right.
It was that kind of thing. And with my mother, no one else in her family had anything like this.
Well, I appreciate the fact that she had had a difficult life, but I can say that she probably, in sitting at in a kitchen or some standing in an area near this, looking out over your beautiful property here, that being able to do that probably helped her in the long
run. Oh yes, yeah. She
make a better day every day.
Yeah, she was intensely interested in everything, and at a point when I in the early 80s, she had trouble holding a book. So she would sit at the kitchen table and she'd read her Bible a little bit every day, and she'd read some of the newspaper every day. But she had a lot of trouble just holding something. So in the early 80s, when I started using the National Library Service for the Blind audiobook program, I thought immediately of her, and I got her on the program, and I got her one of the free players, and I eventually gave her one of my little portable players, which are like the Sony Walkman, which played little cassettes. And so she could read anything she wanted that the National Library Service had. So she started reading more and more that way, which is how I read now.
And you still do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so those are some of the wonderful changes. And then when my husband and I would visit, and then even after, where we would come and visit her because Mom and Dad really liked him, he would sit down with her. He had been in the seminary, and she would ask him questions about religion and philosophy. And he talked to her for a long, long time because he taught humanities and religion and so forth. And it was wonderful to see her so interested in the world and ideas. And so she was a tremendous role model for me. And my dad, too, because he eventually became her full-time caregiver when she became simply completely unable to do anything.
Right, you shared that with us last time.
Yeah. So her life was a gift. And anyone who thinks that being disabled and struggling along doesn't matter, they're wrong. It does. It matters to the people around you, the people who know you, and you just have to keep going because, after all, we are all a few seconds away from some, who knows, accident. We never know. We never know what's going to happen. Life is uncertain, so we have to treasure it. And that's what I learned from my parents.
And that's where we will end.
All right. Thank you.